This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Starting this weekend, University of Michigan's Penny Stamps Speaker Series is rebooting online. It's an amazing chance to hear creative people presenting their work. Writer Isabel Wilkerson will make an appearance. Also the scientist and designer, Dr. Kate Stone. And also my next guest. The New Red Order is a public secret society facilitated by three core contributors. Michigan brothers Zach and Adam Khalil, who are Ojibwe and grew up in northern Michigan. And the third in the trio is Jackson Paulus. He's Tlingit and grew up in Alaska. Zach Khalil and Jackson Paulus are both joining us via Zoom today. Zach, Jackson, good to have you.
Hey, April, thanks so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
You know, I was reading about how the three of you started working together, and I didn't realize until I did so that the name New Red Order, in addition to the reference people may recognize to conspiracy theories, that this is also a riff on a fraternal society that was populated by white men in the 1800s. Would you tell us a little bit about this order and who they were and how you found out about them?
I grew up with an arm of an organization in my hometown of Ketchikan, Alaska, and I really didn't have any idea what it was, except for that they spelled Tlingit wrong, that it seemed like some Eagles fraternal club, and that they, instead of having a representation of a Tlingit person, had what's could be called a Sioux war bonnet.
In Alaska.
In Alaska. So I found this out in an early age, but didn't really realize until a little bit later in my late teens what the organization was. And later, upon being invited to a party there, found their regalia stashed in their closets for their ceremonial adventures. This was the Improved Order of the Red Men, which claims lineage from the Sons of Liberty, who claim responsibility for the Boston Tea Party, and eventually came to include members such as Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Richard Nixon. Didn't allow non-white people in until 1974, and is still continuing with headquarters in Waco, Texas.
So this is a really early example of the kind of performance or alignment with Native people or Native value that goes way back in this country.
Right. And it seems on the front, at least now, kind of ridiculous. But of course, other things in contemporary life seem ridiculous now as well. But you find that this was in a long line of plain Indian in order to become American. So that it was actually very thoroughly embedded in the psyche of what it means to be American. This kind of notion of freedom, this attraction or desire toward freedom that would set one apart from a dictator. And employing the notion, the tactics of what could be called savage warfare in a so-called Revolutionary War context.
I was going to say, so just one of our main aims in thinking about the New Red Order and sort of in contradistinction to the Improved Order of the Red Men is, since the Improved Order of the Red Men still exists, we wanted to create a different organization, a sort of alternative that may have less destructive impact and actually one that sort of looks towards the future as opposed to sort of being mired in the past.
But which may confront and be complicated by desires for indigeneity, which persist back to that time and mode of mimicry.
So one of the works that you're going to be presenting is a short film that she made called Never Settle, Calling In. And it functions as a sort of recruitment video that is not presented exactly as tongue-in-cheek, but definitely has some satirical elements. Can you explain what's happening in it?
Yeah, well, I think you'll be able to get a greater understanding of what's happening when viewing the video. But as you mentioned, the Never Settle Calling In does function as the first step in a series of stages toward recruitment into the public secret society, New Red Order, which it devotes itself to examining desires for indigeneity. Now, the ways that that can be done can vary, but overall, the NRO is investigated to providing a safe space that can act as a facilitation ground for focusing on desires that one might find in oneself towards indigeneity that may be seen as potentially inappropriate, but which also pervade the myths, dreams, and political foundations of the so-called Americas. This is an introduction into what that might be and the full program. In terms of what might occur in initiation with the New Red Order can be found in the further Never Settle video, which is in the Museum of Contemporary Art exhibition.
We should say this is part of this larger campaign that you've presented in a number of artworks that you've shown. There are things like online questionnaires, and there have been some in-person events when that was possible. And it, like you say, it flips the desire that, you know, some white Americans have shown again and again throughout history to connect with something spiritual or essential through a connection with Native culture. And I love the idea of it being treated as sort of a tryout or an interview. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, how these ideas congealed into this kind of presentation for you?
I think to talk about that, it might be useful to go back to one of our earlier works, and not to say, which is a film my brother and I made about the Seven Fires Prophecy and our tribe up in the UP of Michigan, and notice that there was this real desire for these sort of indigenous epistemologies or worldviews or ways of thinking. But that desire was often extractive. It was something that non-Indigenous people wanted to take from Indigenous people and not necessarily give anything back. As filmmakers operating in museums and universities and film festivals, we were often asked to be informants in the typical anthropological sense on our community.
People saying, tell us about the Native experience.
Yeah, tell us about the Native experience, tell us about your tribe, tell us something that'll be useful to us that we can use. You know, there's a long history of that being an extractive, negative thing for Indigenous communities in the Americas, especially in relation to the moving image. That's something we're always really concerned about. At the same time, we don't want to shut down interest in Indigenous subject matter or Indigenous peoples in the United States, because depending on where you are in the United States, we can be so invisible. You know, we don't want to shut down interest in indigeneity, but we also want to make sure that interest manifests in a way that actually benefits Indigenous people and not just non-Indigenous people in a reciprocal way. So in a big way for us, starting this, the New Red Order, this organization, this public secret society, is a way of calling people into that process, of codifying our role as informants, acknowledging that no matter what, as filmmakers, as artists who work in these non-Indigenous spheres, oftentimes in universities, that we do have to act as informants. And since that seems to be so unavoidable and that desire for indigeneity is so deep in the heart of this country and its foundation, that if we can't get around that, then to think about how we can utilize that, how we can channel that desire into forms that actually benefit Indigenous people. And so for us, these sort of like the calling in, you can go to our website, newredorder.org, and join and become a member of this public secret society by informing on yourself and your own culture and your own desires for indigeneity. So in a big way, it's acknowledging that we as Native artists have to act as informants, and then asking our audience, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, to inform along with us on their own cultures.
I really appreciate your use of the phrase calling in. A lot of us are at this point pretty familiar with the phrase in the context of like call out culture. But I think people may not be as familiar with calling in. Can you sort of explain what's meant by that?
Yeah. Well, you find that in a lot of the desire for indigeneity, which may manifest as inappropriate, could occur in instances such as Standing Rock, where there was calling out of people who went along to help advocate for water as life, that those activities might have potentially been seen by Indigenous people as extractive or as missing the point of decolonization. So we find that the use of satirical modes can act as a calling out, which first has to function as an acknowledgement. Because if there is not a calling out, then you're not actually taking the problematicity of that seriously. But when that acknowledgement can kind of function in a loop or get going, then you also recognize that the calling out can function as a further obstruction to desiring indigeneity, because people feel that they can't advocate or express any interest without doing something inappropriate or without overstepping. So we find that employing these views of unfolding satiricality or something like that can act as a way of calling in, because then you find that we, alongside with them, can acknowledge the humor and kind of ludicrousness of the entire situation in which we're so invisibilized.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Zach Khalil, who grew up in Michigan, and Jackson Paulus. They're members of the Public Secret Society, New Red Order. And they'll be presenting as part of the Penny Stamps Lecture Series this weekend. Another part of your work has involved an online questionnaire that offers up questions like, are you interested in learning how to contribute to Indigenous growth? You know, just pretty straightforward. And then, Are you interested in informing on your own culture? If so, describe your ideal level of commitment. And again, that is sort of a practical question that brings the more satirical edge into it. I was thinking about the way that white people sometimes look at Native people to sort of gauge how much they might measure up to a colonial standard of what Native people are like. It feels like in posing these questions, part of what you're doing is flipping the script and asking, you know, people who aren't part of Native culture, who are trying to be allies, you know, if they are performing something in turn. Was that something that was on your mind when you were making the film and in some of these other works that you've used to explore this?
Yes, definitely the performance of the desire for indigeneity and the uncertainty around that is something that's always on our minds. And again, as Zach mentioned, it's coming from a place of understanding ourselves as informants. So that if we can acknowledge our own complicity or our own role in that and the own complications around that, then we find that there is potential for us to examine and acknowledge the kind of awkwardness that might occur with attempting to move toward desires for indigeneity that may occur not just from white people, but from any realm, indigenous people included, who are attempting to understand their own background or inheritance.
Right.
And which, you know, I think the New Right Order is focused a lot on the sort of performance of indigeneity, but also in a big way is really thinking about the performance of allyship, as you were talking about. And the New Right Order makes like a really important distinction between sort of allies and accomplices, based on a text from an Indigenous Media Action Group that we're big fans of. And they draw a distinction between allies and accomplices, where for decolonial struggles in the United States and in a settler colonial context, to be an ally is strictly performative. It's lip service almost by definition. And to be an accomplice is to actually work alongside Indigenous people. And thinking about the word accomplice is a person who helps another commit a crime. But decolonization, a truly decolonial act, has to be against the law in a settler colonial context. So that's another distinction that we like to draw.
The visual style for your projects have so much going on in them. There are elements, and this is true of Inaatse for sure, there are elements of documentary, but also collage scenes and set pieces that you create, sometimes illustration. Is the density of your work product, is that something that you build in on purpose or just something that has evolved as you get going and figure out the rhythms that you're going for?
That density is really an intrinsic, intentional part of our practice and our process, ranging from Inaatse to our work with the New Right Order. And I think a lot of that for us is speaking to multiple audiences at the same time and sort of trying to code a film vertically, layers on top of each other, as opposed to sort of horizontally over time. At any one moment or period of the film, there are a lot of visual layers going on, and then also conceptually, there are a lot of layers going on that speak to different audiences, both like my own tribe in the EP, at the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians, speaking to Ojibwe people in general, Anishinaabe people, Native American people, Indigenous people, non-Indigenous people. It's sort of like onions of different audiences that the film is crafted for. And I think that that visual style sort of speaks to that. And then also, I think we're really interested in thinking about the ways that film and the moving image has been used as a tool against Indigenous people for so long through the sort of extractive, destructive impulses of visual anthropology and ethnography, and trying to come up with, you know, how there's different forms of like national cinema, like Japanese cinema or French cinema, trying to think about what an Anishinaabe or Ojibwe form of cinema would be and how that could be coded into a different cinematic language.
And I think for the New Red Order films, the kind of density is amplified even further because we're, you know, speaking to multiple audiences, but also speaking about different forms of ingestion or appropriation. And so by utilizing and mimicking those same forms, we are able to kind of collapse modalities into a way that can hopefully speak to multiple audiences, like Zach mentioned.
Our ideas about narrative are so shaped by culture and language. I do remember as a teenager picking up a collection of Anishinaabe stories that had been published in Canada, and I just wasn't prepared, you know, like I didn't understand the story forms, which is neither here nor there, except that that was the first time it occurred to me that someone who grew up with a different idea about even sentence structure or myth might encounter something like the Brothers Grimm and, you know, just like not really find anything to relate to. Could you each talk a little bit about influences on your own sense of story?
Yeah, Zach here. I mean, I think for me and my brother in particular, being Ojibwe, that oral tradition is really important to us. And also to think about not only how stories are structured, but why they're structured that way and what's their intention, what's the use of stories besides entertainment or education. And for us, I think, and not to say the film that's going to be playing tonight is a great example of that.
Well, it's much more an artifact of a modern sensibility.
Yeah, in some ways, but also a very traditional sensibility, both. And I think that those two things aren't necessarily in opposition in any way whatsoever. But it, and not to say the film is based upon the Seven Fires prophecy, which is like an ancient Anishinaabe story and prophecy that's been passed throughout the generations that has many different versions and many different interpretations of what it means. But fundamentally, it's a story that both predates and predicts the arrival of Europeans in the Americas, and a story that seeks to guide the Anishinaabe people through this and into the future in ways that are hopefully more productive and helpful for Anishinaabe people in general. So it's also a story that's like linear and nonlinear. It moves through time. In a way, it's a way of manifesting history in the present to serve the future. And I think that that's a really intrinsic part of the way that we think about storytelling, the kinds of stories we tell and what they're for.
Yeah. And I think with the moving into the potential narrative devices one might recognize in Never Settle Calling In, which of course is an introductory video and doesn't have the time to expand into the narrative in a way, I think the sense of story does refer in large part to what we were talking about earlier in terms of the collapse, the density of information, where in Tlingit oral history, you always find that there are citations that continually interrupt the flow of the story. So I think some of that is filtering in, at least into the New Red Order material.
Mm-hmm. I think also to follow up on that, specifically with Never Settled Calling In, you know, it is a recruitment video in the typical sort of commercial capitalistic sense, where it's almost an advertisement or an infomercial or a cult indoctrination video. It's kind of trying to blur the distinction between all those things and kind of taking bits of style from each of them. And part of that is also just to acknowledge the ways in which indigeneity is often, you know, twisted and used for in commercial ways and sold, but trying to utilize that for hopefully better ends in the long run, to kind of call people in to think more critically about how and why they want to engage with Indigenous people and their own settler colonial realities.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Zach Khalil and Jackson Paulus of New Red Order. They're presenting work as part of the Stamps speaker series this weekend, and there may be more of their work on view in Michigan soon. Could you both say a few words about how you settled into visual and conceptual art as the kind of place to say the things that you wanted to say?
Yeah, I'll go. Jackson here. I'm coming from Alaska. My father, Nathan Jackson, was a kind of a renowned Tlingit carver in the Northwest Coast. So I grew up under him working. I grew up behind stanchions for boatloads of tourists coming in on buses into Saxman Native Village to watch Native people carve. I grew up with a simultaneous inheritance of that culture and a desire to move it forward and to continue it, but also an uncomfortability with the way that that was continually digested. And so I began an art career, partly because, I mean, it's not that all that I knew how to do at the time, but it's what I realized, like, were certain gifts or potentialities that I had that wouldn't be able to express in other modes.
How about you, Zach?
You know, I grew up watching way too many movies and TV, and that shaped who I am in a big way, for better or for worse. And I think as I grew up, I was able to realize how much that was the case. And that gave me a real interest in learning how to edit, learning how to make visual media, whether film or television, and to sort of see some of the codes and logic that are embedded in that form, and to be able to sort of reverse engineer that for myself. And then also thinking again about the ways that the moving image has played such a crucial role in the way that people think about Indigenous peoples in the Americas was always really important to me. I was really drawn to visual media because of its power and its ability to say things that you can't say in any other way, and that leave room for ambiguity and paradox, but they can also open up a more profound space to contemplate some really difficult realities.
Right. New Red Order has managed to carve out space to show your work amid institutions. And sometimes that means interacting with places like art galleries and art museums, which have behaved in really damaging ways to Native people and Native artifacts, probably more times than we can count. Is it harder to find institutions that you feel you can work with and feel okay about?
Zach, that's a really good question. I would say I don't think we've ever really felt that way. That we ever feel really comfortable with the institutions we're working with generally. Mm-hmm. There's always a few exceptions here or there. But, you know, people talk about decolonization as a sort of catch-all term for improving institutions or schools. But I think it's interesting to think about, like, how can you decolonize a colonial institution, such as, like, a university or that's a museum of natural history. And I would argue that you probably can't, you know, you kind of have to tear it down in the first place. And I realize that's probably not a popular opinion. But to that sense, like, we don't necessarily think that any of the institutions that we work with have a clean bill of health or are necessarily ethical. But in our engagement with them, we try to utilize that their platform and their resources to call attention to the ways in which they and the society that creates them is not ethical and does need to change. I think as informants, if we were only willing to collaborate with institutions that we thought were ethically impervious, I don't think there would be anybody to collaborate with, almost, hate to say it.
Sad commentary. You were actually in that situation a couple of months ago when Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit came under fire for the way that its director at the time was treating staff, and specifically people of color who were on staff and curators who the museum worked with. You had a show scheduled there that sort of went on hold. And I just wondered if you've made any decisions about whether you're going to go forward doing some work with them.
So we had a show, our first solo museum exhibition that was set to open on July 9th at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. Mm-hmm. And there was a resistance amongst the staff to executive leadership in particular at the museum, as well as a sort of long list of other grievances and concerns, all of which were very legitimate. So, you know, we were in a fortunate position where we became aware of this before our show opened. The staff had a list of five action items or demands which they wanted the museum to meet, in particular changing the director. And all those demands to us seemed very reasonable. And we were in a unique position before the show opened, where as artists, we had power that the staff didn't have necessarily. So we wanted to utilize the power that we had to essentially tell the institution that they couldn't open the show until they agreed to meet all of the staff's demands. You know, we're currently in negotiations with the institution still, but it's, you know, it's really up to the museum board and the decisions that they're willing to make to reformulate their institution to be more accountable to its community. And I also just do want to say that we've worked with a lot of really amazing people at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. And although the leadership was not in a good place, there are a lot of great people that work there, and a lot of amazing people in the community, and that we're also incredibly proud of the show that we were able to put together there, and really want people in Detroit and all over Michigan and the area to come see it.
Jackson, Zach, your work is always concerned with not just pointing out, you know, the obstacles to Native people having more agency in their lives and some growth, but in figuring out ways to expand that. Do you think it's possible to harness all these trappings of performance, you know, the feather tattoos, the dream catchers, the sage bundles, in some way that is truly helpful to Native people?
I mean, I think those things that you just referenced are generally, and I think that's why you referenced them, are generally, you know, superficial. They're sort of easily digestible symbols.
And made into commodities, easy to buy and sell.
Exactly. And commodities that are perfectly suited towards our particularly insane existential environmental catastrophe, where, like, there are commodities that are supposed to be easily consumed to make people feel like they're engaging with indigeneity and something more authentic. I hate that word. So, yeah, I don't necessarily think that those things are are ways of engaging with indigeneity that can actually be particularly helpful or useful to indigenous people. On the other hand, I think there are symbols that certain non-indigenous people respond to and are drawn to. And I think, you know, we can kind of, they can be used in a sort of bait and switch, perhaps, to get people who may be interested in a more superficial engagement to actually think critically about their own relationship to indigeneity and settler colonialism.
One way that people can pursue their indigeneity or to find more is to go to newredorder.org or potentially call the hotline 1-888-NEW-RED-1.
It's a toll-free hotline, 1-888-NEW-RED-1. The thing that I want to kind of foreground this all with is that the New Red Order is, in some sense, is a provocation, and in a larger sense is the beginning of a larger conversation. We don't pretend to have answers to a lot of these questions, but there are questions that we think we all need to start asking each other and start talking about and thinking through together. And so, yeah, I just want to really highlight that fact that this isn't something that's complete in any way whatsoever. It's the start of, you know, a long process that is going to take generations. But that we just want to try to think of ways to get around some of these obstructions to actually engaging thoughtfully, directly, critically with these questions. And I mean that really genuinely, really interested in what people out there think about all of this, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people.
Zach Khalil and Jackson Paulus are part of New Red Order, and they're leading off the Penny Stamps Distinguished Speaker Series for the University of Michigan Stamp School of Art and Design. Their webcast is starting tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Audiences can also tune in and join the conversation on the archive series for the page. Zach, Jackson, it's been really nice talking to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for the question.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.